You are listening to the Midcurrent Church Podcast. This week's message is from our series titled, Quiet Quitting. For more information and to visit us online, check us out at midcurrentchurch.org and find us on Facebook and Instagram. And now, here is Pastor Sten Carlson with today's message.
Sometimes success can actually be dangerous, right? It can trick us into thinking that we've got nothing to worry about, when in fact, maybe there is something to be worried about. Let me give you one very specific example of what I'm getting at. I see this phenomenon over and over again when I play pickup games of basketball at the YMCA. We split into teams of five, we play games to 15, and if you win, you play again, right? And if you keep winning, you keep playing, and you just, whatever next, you know, group of five guys is ready to come in, you play against them. Every now and again, the stars will align, and there will be one team that assembles randomly that is practically unbeatable, right? They have all the size, they have all the best players, all the experience, all the guys who have all the chemistry together, and they just keep winning. And again, if you keep winning, you keep on playing. For the most part, games are always relatively competitive, but also every now and again, there will be an incoming team of five, right? The next five up, there will be an incoming team that is just completely overmatched. They have no size, they have like none of the best players, they have like no experience, and this team of five coming in has like no chemistry at all, and it's just kind of the unfortunate luck of the draw. Here's the problem. We don't typically, when we're playing, we don't typically adjust the teams, you know, to try to make them fair every time. It's just kind of like next five up. Whoever's next waiting to come in, it's the next five and you go. That's just the way that we've been playing for so long. But sometimes it is the next group coming in, like Durant, you know, this group of guys coming in and playing against these guys that have just won like 20 straight games, right? Sometimes it's such a mismatch that the team coming in, they will actually object. They're going like, come on, you guys. This is, I mean, they're just looking at their team. They're looking at the team that's winning. They're going like, this is like so unfair. You guys have all of the best players. You've won like 10 games in a row. You've got us, you know, like we're outmatched at every single position, right? And so the team coming in, sometimes you're going, come on, you guys, like let's just switch up the teams. Otherwise, this won't even be fun. Unfortunately, despite the fact that people can see like, oh yeah, this is not going to be a great game. Well, that's just not how we play. We don't match. It just keeps going. Next five up, next five up, next five up. Unfortunately, we don't switch it up to try to make it fair. But here's what I have observed. I kid you not. Here's what I have observed after about 9 years of playing basketball at the Hudson YMCA. The more a team complains, because typically you don't. Everybody understands that. This is just how it goes. Next five up. Here's what I've observed. The more a team complains about how unfair a game is going to be, the more likely they end up winning that game. It's unbelievable. I see it all the time. Now when people are complaining, I'm going like, you guys are going to win. Now that you complained, it's a surefire deal that you're going to win the game. To everybody's surprise in these moments, like the team that, even the team that is complaining, to everybody's surprise, the team that complains the loudest every single time somehow finds a way to come out on top. It's unbelievable. Everybody can see it. They're like, well, this game, this is ridiculous. They're amazing. They're not, they're like, this is that, you know, if you complain about it, it's a surefire way you're going to come out on top. Now, I don't know how to explain this other than to suggest that the all-star team's confidence has lulled them to sleep. You know what I'm saying? I don't exactly know how else to explain how this happens, because it happens all the time, other than to suggest that the team that's kept on, their confidence just lulled them to sleep. Their reputation in the last hour, it kind of ruined them, right? Their track record over the last 10 games, it kind of tricked them into thinking that they had this in the bag, and they were so sure that they would win the game that what happens is they kind of forget to actually show up and play the game itself, and they lose every single time. For me, I told you, it's a very specific example of a greater point that I'm trying to make. And that point is this. This whole deal highlights the reality to me in so many different aspects of our life. It highlights the reality to me that being successful often makes us susceptible to setback. I want to say that again, right? In a lot of different areas of in our life, here's what happens. Being successful at something, somewhere in our life, being successful oftentimes makes us susceptible to experiencing some kind of setback. The more successful we are in a particular area of our life, the more susceptible we are to kind of falling asleep at the wheel. That the more susceptible we are to kind of just phoning it in, thinking like, yeah, I've got this in the bag. The more susceptible we are to just forgetting to show up and play the game or do the thing or step into whatever it is that we need to be stepping into. Right? Sometimes being successful at something, it makes us a little more susceptible to experiencing a setback that we didn't see coming and that we don't really want in the end. And the very same thing is true in our relationship with God. And that's a little bit of what I want to talk about today. I want to spend our morning talking about today as we begin this brand new message series called Quiet Quitting. What in the world kind of series is that? Let me explain it to you. There's a recent workplace trend. This was fascinating to me to read about. There's a recent workplace trend that has identified in the last handful of years an increase in working professionals who only do the bare minimum requirements of their job. And they put in no more time, no more effort, no more enthusiasm than is absolutely necessary to do the job. And it's gotten a name, this kind of approach, this kind of mentality in the last number of years, especially among younger generations, it's been given a name, this only do the minimum kind of thing. It's been referred to as quiet quitting. Okay, here's the deal in these situations, right? No one is actually quitting. Nobody is like actually turning in the resignation letters. Nobody that's referred to like this. Nobody's actually just like skipping shifts of work. But what's happening is that they're recognizing so many people and the working professionals in the workforce that they're just kind of going through the motions. Right? That they're doing just enough to look the part, but their heart is really not in it. And so borrowing from this recent corporate trend, we're going to take the next 3 weeks in this month of June to identify some of the dangers of a similar sort of phenomenon creeping into our spiritual life. My concern is not that people are outright just walking away from faith. But my concern is that there is distance growing in our spiritual life, distance growing between us and God, us and the things that we care about the most, and we're not even aware of it. And so if your faith feels stagnant, if your faith in your spiritual life is maybe not what you hoped it would be, my hope is in the next 3 weeks that we will identify some of the areas of spiritual life that might be worth paying more attention to. Next week, we're going to identify what it looks like. Not that this is the goal, but we're going to identify what it looks like when we're quietly quitting on spiritual disciplines in our life. The week after that, on June 21st, we're going to identify what it looks like when we're quietly quitting on some of the spiritual responsibilities that God has given us. And today, we're going to identify, not that it's a goal, but we want to be mindful of it. We're going to identify what it looks like when we actually just start quietly quitting on God. Quietly quitting on a relationship with God Himself. Typically, people don't wake up one morning and you go, you know what, I'm done with God. Does that happen? I'm sure that it does. But what I'm suggesting to you today is that typically we don't wake up, nobody wakes up and goes, you know what? I've just decided I'm absolutely done with God. But over time, too many people will see their relationship with God kind of just fade into the background in a way that they, quite frankly, they never really intended. This wasn't a choice, but it just starts to happen. Their relationship with God will fade into the background in a way that they never intended, in a way that they never really saw coming. And so I want to try to figure out today how in the world that could even happen. How does quietly quitting on God even happen in our everyday life? To do so, we're going to turn our attention all the way, actually, to the very last book in the Bible, to the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation is the recording of what Jesus revealed to John, and it begins with letters that were written to seven different churches, and these letters were intended to do one of any handful of things, depending on who the letter was written to, but the letters essentially were intended to encourage, or to correct, or to redirect, or to strengthen churches that were struggling to follow Jesus faithfully amid both like external pressures in the world and in the midst of just kind of an internal spiritual drift. And so this morning, we're going to read from Revelation chapter 3, where Jesus is issuing a warning to the church in a city whose reputation and success had made them susceptible to failure in a way that they really would have never imagined and in a way that they really didn't see coming. This particular city's past provided Jesus the perfect opportunity to warn the church of a similar fate. And I want us to read, and I want us to see what that warning was today. So we're going to turn to Revelation chapter 3. I'm going to read actually today from the Message translation of the Bible, just to help us here with this passage get a really clear understanding, as clear an understanding as possible, without, in this specific case, sacrificing any real accuracy. And so here's the message that Jesus revealed to John. He says this: write this to Sardis, write to the church in the city of Sardis. Write this to them. I see right through your work. You have a reputation for vigor and zest. The literal translation is you have a reputation for being alive, from looking like you've got it going, but here's the warning. You have a reputation for looking alive, reputation for vigor and zest, but you're dead, stone dead, it says. AKA, the warning is, hey, you kind of look the part, but your heart is really not in it. Jesus, I want to make this clear for us just so we understand what's happening. Jesus is addressing the church in Sardis, not necessarily the city itself, but here's what's interesting. The city of Sardis, just in and of itself, had an interesting reputation for being a once great and really prominent and prosperous city. In fact, the city of Sardis in itself had never in its history been overtaken in conventional methods of like war and conflict, which was more common among nations and cities in this day. It had never in its history been overtaken by conventional methods of war and conflict. And its citizens, of which included Christians, they would have grown up. They would have likely been taught this kind of history of this proud and prominent city. They would have been taught of this very prominent reputation. But here's the sobering side of this, the same side of this coin. Here's the sobering reality of which Christians in Sardis would have also been familiar. Twice Sardis had been unexpectedly overtaken. Never overtaken by conventional methods of conflict and war, but twice the city had been unexpectedly overtaken because the proud Sardians had failed to adequately keep watch over their city. They thought, we're too great. We're too prosperous. We've never had a problem before. We've never been beaten once before. And so they stopped taking seriously the need to actually keep watch and to protect themselves. And so twice they were overtaken because they failed to, they failed to keep watch as they should. The reality is their track record, it tricked them into thinking, We're good. The track record tricked them. So and citizens and Christians included, they would have known of this history of the city of Sardis. And so Jesus is drawing upon local history that everybody would have been aware of to issue a similar warning to Christians in Sardis who were what? They were growing more and more comfortable with their spiritual status. They were growing more and more comfortable with kind of prior moments of spiritual prominence. And at the same time, they were growing more and more comfortable with so many other cultural and religious influences and trends that were just kind of creeping into the world around them. And so here's the warning that is issued to them. Verse 2 and 3, it says this. Up on your feet. That's the warning. Up on your feet. The literal translation is wake up. Take a deep breath. Maybe there's life in you yet, but I wouldn't know it by looking at your busy work. Nothing of God's work has been completed. Your condition is desperate, right? Jesus is saying, hey, sure, there's a lot of like activity. Sure, there's a lot of stuff that kind of looks like the right thing to do, but there's not a lot of productivity in terms of the things that God is actually calling you to. Here's the rest of the warning. Think of the gift you once had in your hands, the message you once heard with your ears. Grasp it again. You had it once. You heard it once. Okay? Grasp it again and turn back to God. Listen to this final warning. If you pull the covers back over your head and sleep on, oblivious to God, I'll return, Jesus says, when you least expect it, break into your life like a thief in the night. The warning to the church in Sardis is to wake up, to show up, and to get back in the game. Not to just rest on a reputation, not to rest on a previous track record or any past moments of prominence or any past moments of spiritual significance as a church. The warning is to not get too comfortable. Not to get too comfortable with your own past and to not get too comfortable with all the other stuff that is creeping up around you. And if you compare this warning to some of the other warnings to the other churches that were, that were written to in the book of Revelation, what you would see is that the Christians in Sardis, they weren't like some of the Christians in the other places. Letters to some of the other churches were written to encourage or to correct for a variety of different reasons. One church had just kind of stopped loving God and loving others, and they had stopped loving the lost. Others were facing real difficult persecution. Some had just kind of compromised and had abandoned the message of Jesus. But Sardis was unique. Because Sardis was unique because here's the deal. There was no like outrageous sin that existed among the people. There was no just egregious sin. There was no persecution. There was no like temptation that they were really being warned about. They had the letter is written to them not because of just some gross, negligence or ugliness, or I cannot believe that this kind of sin is. There was nothing like this happening. All that was happening is that they had grown too complacent, too comfortable, okay, too tolerant of the world around them. There was no, ultimately what Jesus was warning is that there was, what he was recognizing is that it kind of looked like there were some of the right things to do, but what he was recognizing is there was no price that the Sardin church was, the church in Sardis, there was no price that these Jesus followers were willing to pay for their faith. There was not some kind of just egregious, sin or whatever happening. He was just going, it's just all too kind of like, eh. And there was no price that the church was willing to pay for their faith in Jesus. What was happening is that they were quietly quitting on God. And in this state, Jesus is warning that he's going, you very well may be taken by surprise when I return once again. Okay? No egregious sin. Just kind of a comfort and a casualness to faith in Jesus and to a commitment to God that Jesus is warning about. And here's the deal. Here's why all of this revelation letters to churches and ancient cities. Here's what this has to do. Here's why this matters to us. Because the warning to the church in Sardis, I think it should generate, at the very least, it should generate a moment of introspection for us as Jesus followers today. I think the warnings is to make us not get too casual, right? We may think that we're, you know, we may think that we're fully alive. We may think we're really doing it because of some past moments of prominence or because of some kind of box that we checked that makes us feel like we're doing the things that we need to do. We may think like we're really doing it when the reality is that we too may have become pretty comfortable with our own life. We may be, have become too comfortable with some of the other trends and some of the influences that are happening around us, that we become too satisfied with the status quo, kind of just going through the motions. And so like both the city of Sardis and the church in Sardis, this is what we have to think about for ourselves. It can become far too easy to depend on past achievements, past blessings, past spiritual highs, past spiritual commitments, right? Instead of continually, daily pursuing God's call in our lives for the future. Too easy to kind of go like, well, here's all the stuff that I've done in the past without you really going, hey, what is the new call on my life each and every day into the future? It's far too easy to rest on a reputation rather than continually pursuing a relationship with God. Far easy to develop confidence based on, you know, the comfortable life that we've built for ourselves and maybe the blessing that we assume, you know, God has, you know, placed upon us. And so the letter to the church in Sardis, if we think about it, it really could have been written to us as well. It could have been written to us as a warning about getting too casual with our commitment to God and to God's call on our life in the real everyday world that we live in every single day. Just to try to get a full picture of this, I want to jump back to the days of the Old Testament, just to give us a full picture throughout Scripture of this, because a similar warning, right? A warning to not get too casual, a warning to not just kind of rest on spiritual significance at one time while forgetting to continue it out for all time. There's a similar warning that unfolds thousands of years prior in the days of the Old Testament, just to give you another example of what I'm getting at. This is actually one of my favorite stories in the Old Testament. It's the story of Gideon. Here's a real quick, just kind of Cliff Notes version of this part of Gideon's story. Gideon is preparing, you know, to lead God's people, or at least to protect God's people in a battle against the Midianites. And Gideon has over, I think it's 33,000 soldiers. He has over 30,000 soldiers prepared to defend God's people against the Midianites, who already have them outnumbered astronomically. So he's got 30,000 soldiers. God says to Gideon, he says, no. I know you're already outnumbered, even with 30,000 some troops, but God says to Gideon, no, you got too many troops. He says to Gideon, if you win this fight, you're going to take all the credit for it. You're going to think it's you did it, and you're not going to give any credit to me. And so Gideon whittled his men down to 20,000 troops. He told 10,000 plus to go home. God says, no, you still got too many troops. If you win, you're going to take credit for it, and you're going to forget that I had any hand in this. And so Gideon keeps whittling down his troops all the way down to just 300 men. And then God says, perfect. Now if you win, you'll know that it was me who saved you. And that was what God wanted Gideon and his people to understand. So, spoiler alert here, Gideon and his 300 men, they successfully defend themselves and defeat the Midianites with God's help in a stunning, in an unbelievable moment that plays out, that they saved themselves with God's help. Here's what happens. All of the people, in moments of celebration, all the people bring Gideon pieces of gold that he melts down into to form into some kind of golden statue. Here's what happened. Gideon, he took the gold, he melted it down, and then he made it into this golden statue. He did this because everyone's all hyped up. He melted it all down, made the statue to commemorate the victory. But then he failed to destroy it or to redirect his people when they started to worship it. Okay, they all brought him gold as a way to celebrate. Gideon melted it down. They built a thing to go, man, this was an amazing moment in the life of our people. And it was meant to be a moment to celebrate what God has done. But Gideon failed to divert their attention to destroy the golden statue when the people started worshiping it instead of God. Listen to Judges chapter 8, verse 27. It says this: Gideon made a sacred ephod from the gold, and he put it in Ophrah, his hometown. But soon, all of the Israelites that they gave of themselves, it says they prostituted themselves by worshiping it. And it, this gold statue, it became a trap for Gideon and his family. Here was the unfortunate long-term result that happened in verse 33. As soon as Gideon died, look what happens. The Israelites, once again, they gave of themselves. They prostituted themselves by worshiping the images of Baal, making Baal-berith their god. And they forgot the Lord their God, who had rescued them from all of their enemies surrounding them, nor did they show any loyalty to the family of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, despite all of the good that he had done for Israel. Okay? In these days, it took so much effort. I mean, it takes so much effort for us these days too. But it took so much effort in these days, and it took so much godly leadership to get God's people away from worshiping gold statues and worshiping idols and worshiping false gods. And they had made so much progress, only for Gideon's complacency to sabotage any progress they had made. Okay? They created the statue in a moment of celebration, but then Gideon failed to destroy it when it became the object of everybody's worship. Mid-Current, here's what I'm trying to get at today by looking at warnings to churches in ancient cities written about in the book of Revelation. Here's what I'm trying to get at now and then by rewinding all the way back to Old Testament battlefields. What I want us to understand today is this, that spiritual apathy, it rarely begins with a dramatic rejection of God, but with oftentimes just a gradual disengagement from God's priorities. Are there moments when some choose in a dramatic fashion to reject God? Sure. But what I want to warn us today, as I warn us about the reality of quietly quitting on God, is the idea that spiritual decline in our life, it is rarely a result of just some kind of dramatic rejection where we turned our back on God. But most of the time, it's a result of just a subtle, gradual disengagement, backing away without even knowing it, a gradual disengagement from God's priorities and God's call on our lives. And in this regard, here's what I would say. My greatest concern, right? I've got my pastor hat on, I'm looking at my church, I'm looking at the people that I'm trying to lead, I'm looking at our community, I'm looking at the Big C Church and Christians worldwide. Here's what I would say. My greatest concern for the church today is not necessarily that too many Jesus followers are too interested in, you know, in drugs, sex, and rock and roll. I mean, is that a concern? Sure, that is a concern. But I'm just going, like, my greatest concern as I look out as a spiritual leader, it's not that too many Christians are too interested in just this egregious life of you know, whatever, drugs, sex, rock and roll, down the line. My greatest concern for Jesus followers today is that too many Jesus followers are just too casual in their commitment to God's call on their lives. My concern is that Christianity, right, is being reduced to like a one-time decision, a big spiritual moment back in the past someday. The Christianity is being reduced to a one-time decision for Jesus rather than daily devotion to Jesus and to his call on our lives. My greatest concern, although there are plenty of things to be concerned about, my greatest concern is that we've made it all about believing in Jesus, which is good, and I want more people to believe in Jesus, but that we've made it more about just believing sometime long ago rather than, quite frankly, just behaving like Jesus more and more and more in our everyday lives. The result is something similar to what I have heard referred to as vampire Christians. Anyone ever heard of a vampire Christian before? It's a term that was first introduced by the famous theologian Dallas Willard. He describes vampire Christians as those who want Jesus only for his blood and little to nothing else. It's a vampire Christian. Right? Those who want Jesus only for his blood and little to nothing else. But vampire Christians, Dallas Willard is suggesting, are those who are ultimately interested in kind of the results of a life of faith, the results of what Jesus has done, the result of what Jesus offers to them, but are not so much interested, at least by the way they live their lives, are not so much interested in what a living, active, daily relationship with Jesus requires of them. It's people who want the benefit. They want the benefit in their life without the burden. In somewhat of a dramatic example, the great prison evangelist Chuck Colson, he alludes to this. He doesn't say it specifically in terms of this vampire Christian thought, which I think, man, that should be an alarming picture to the church today. But in a kind of a dramatic example, prison evangelist Chuck Colson, he alludes to the same kind of idea when he writes about a man named Mickey Cohen, who was a famous Los Angeles gangster in the 1940s. When Mickey made a public profession of faith, made a decision to follow Jesus with his life, his new Christian friends were elated. What an amazing story, right? Gangster turned to Jesus, right? They were so thrilled. But as time passed, they began to wonder why Mickey Cohen didn't really leave his old gangster lifestyle. And so they brought this to his attention, and he kind of protested, going, "Hey, you never really said this was a part of the deal." He protested, going like, you guys never really said I had to give up my career. You never really said I had to give up my friends. He's going, there's Christian movie stars, there's Christian athletes, there's Christian businessmen. So what's the problem with being a Christian gangster? He said to them, if I have to give it all up, if that's what Christianity really is, then he said, count me out. And ultimately, he drifted away from Christian circles. He drifted away from following after Jesus. And he died, it says, he died a lonely and a forgotten man. And here's how Chuck Colson, a great prison evangelist, here's how Chuck Colson reflected about Mickey Cohen's life. He says, Cohen was echoing the millions of professing Christians who, though unwilling to admit it, through their very lives, pose the same question, not about being a Christian gangster, but about being Christianized versions of whatever they already are and are determined to remain. It's a picture, in my estimation, of vampire Christianity, right? Benefit, yes, we would like the sound of that, but it's benefit without the burden. When we're interested in the result of a life of faith and not so much in a relationship with Jesus and what God has asked of us and invited us into in return. And here's the deal, gang. As your pastor, I don't want any of you to quit on your relationship with God, but I especially don't want anyone to quit without really even realizing it. And so let me just ask you a tough question. I'll admit, tough question here today, but let me ask you, when was the last time that your faith asked something hard of you? Right? What part of your relationship with God needs you to start showing up again? Right? Your spiritual reputation might be in great shape. Right, your kind of track record of some really great moments along the way. Your track record might be terrific. Your outer appearance, you know, you do all the Christian-y things, right? Your outer appearance may be stellar. But what does daily obedience to God ask of you? And are you showing up for it? It's never too late to start showing up where it matters most. Mick Kern, here's the good news. Jesus doesn't write this letter to Sardis because he's given up on them. Oh, you guys are, you know. He doesn't write the letter because he's given up on them. He writes it because he hasn't given up on them. And so the warning here to wake up, it's actually an invitation to all of us to just start showing up once again. And so that's my question, my encouragement, my challenge to you today. Where will you start showing up again? When it comes to a daily, active, living, genuine relationship with Jesus, where will you start showing up again? Maybe you've realized your faith has become more just about a reputation built on some moment from the past rather than a relationship. Maybe you've been living off of yesterday's victories, yesterday's decisions, yesterday's experiences, yesterday's commitments to God. Maybe you've kind of been going through the motions, but if you were honest and took a hard look, you'd realize your heart is really not in it. If that's you, I want you to hear the graciousness in these words of Jesus. He doesn't say it's too late for you. He says, wake up. It's time to start showing up once again. Wake up to the God who is still speaking, to the God who is still calling you, and to the God who has a great purpose for your life still. Imagine, gang, imagine what would happen if a church full of people, if Mid-Current Church was full of people who stopped settling for comfortable or casual Christianity. Imagine marriages strengthened because people were pursuing God again. Imagine families being transformed because parents were pursuing God again and leading with intentional faith. Imagine neighbors and coworkers and friends encountering Jesus, seeing Jesus more in us because his people, we were no longer sleepwalking through this life. The future that Jesus envisions is not a church living on its reputation. It's a church that is living out a daily relationship with Jesus. It's a church that's fully alive. So gang, let's not quietly quit on God. Let's wake up, which just means we start showing up once again. And we discover that God is not finished with us yet. Let me pray. God, thank you for the amazing gift that you have given us in your Son, Jesus Christ. God, for the message of it, for the reality of him showing up. You didn't just shout your love from heaven. You literally showed up. You sent your Son, Jesus, into this world to be among us, God. And I am praying, obviously, God, I as a spiritual leader in this community, I'm praying that more and more and more people would choose to believe in that gift. Yes, God, I want every single person that steps through these doors to believe in your Son, Jesus. But at the same time, God, I don't want it to just end there. It's not just about a belief. It's not about a one-time decision that sits in the past. God, I'm praying that more and more of us would choose to become more like, to start behaving more like, to pursuing a Jesus-like life in a relationship with Jesus every single day in a way that would keep us in the game, God, that would keep us alert to the call that you have placed on our lives. God, give us the strength, give us the courage. God, help us to see in our own lives the places where we need to start showing up again. And would you meet us in those places? And would you strengthen us in those places? Would you encourage us in those places? And lift our eyes to the great call you have for each one of us. And we pray this in your name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this week's message from Midcurrent Church. For more information and to visit us online, check out midcurrentchurch.org and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Be sure to join us on Sunday mornings, both online and in person at 9 and 10:30 a.m. Midcurrent is located at 200 First Street in downtown Hudson, Wisconsin.